The boy is perhaps 12 years old, and the knight has settled fully over Tenochtitlan by the time his grandmother takes his hand. The city gleams beneath a low, heavy moon. Canals thread between the causeways like dark ribbon, catching just enough starlight to seem, for a moment, like a second sky laid flat across the water. Temple fires burn steadily against the obsidian dark small orange wounds in an otherwise black horizon. Tomorrow, there will be a ceremony at the Templo Mayor. The boy has heard the adults speaking of it in low voices for days, a particular hush that always seems to settle over the household before a sacred rite. He walks beside his grandmother through the crowded streets. His arms are full of marigolds, their bittersweet smell mixing with copal smoke drifting from a doorway somewhere ahead. She points upward without breaking her stride. The moon hangs pale and heavy above them, caught in that strange silvered light it always seems to carry just before a ceremony. "Do you see her?" she asks. "The moon?" he says, uncertain what else there could be to see. "No," she says quietly, and something in her voice makes him stop walking entirely. "Goyalshoki." He squints upward. Only silver light. Only shadow moving faintly across a pale, familiar surface that he has looked at nearly every night of his life without ever once being asked to truly see it. His grandmother kneels beside him in the street, heedless of the mud, and takes his chin gently in her hand, turning his face back toward the sky. "Long ago," she whispers, "she climbed the mountain with anger in her heart. She believed she understood justice better than anyone else standing on that summit that night." The wind moves over the lake beyond the causeway, carrying the faint sound of drumming from somewhere near the temple precinct. "But the gods," she continues, "were making something larger than justice, something the mountain itself could barely hold." Above them, the moon slides fully behind a passing cloud, and for a moment, the boy and his grandmother stand together in total darkness, marigolds crushed slightly against his chest. The city's fires, the only remaining light. Far above, faint as breath, bells seem to sing somewhere in the night. Though whether it is real sound, temple bells carried on wind from streets far away, or simply the boy's own imagination reaching for the shape of the story his grandmother had just given him, neither of them could say for certain. Neither of them tries to find out. Some things his grandmother has taught him are meant to remain half-heard. Today, we are going to travel to central Mexico, the heart of Tenochtitlan, capital of the Mexica world, where one goddess lies shattered beneath a sacred mountain, and she's lain there in one form or another for at least 500 years. Her name is Coyolxochitl. She is moonlight and rebellion in the same breath. She is severed limbs carved into 3.5 meters of solid stone. She is a story colonial friars tried to record, misunderstood, and sometimes quietly preserves all at once. She is memory that outlasted an empire's destruction, buried under a cathedral for 4.5 centuries before a work crew's shovel found her again by accident. Coyolxochitl was a major divine figure within Mexica religion, one whose story sat at the literal architectural center of the Mexica capital. Her name comes from Nahuatl, Coyolxochitl, generally translated as "she who has bells on her cheeks" or "painted with bells," a reference to the golden bell-shaped ornaments consistently depicted adorning her face in surviving artwork. She is typically understood as a moon deity, though the scholarly record is not entirely settled on that point. Some researchers argue her original portfolio extended beyond the moon alone, into a broader association with stars and the wider forces that govern the night sky, a celestial power rather than a single celestial body. Scholars have noted that Mesoamerican celestial goddesses were rarely confined reflect one fixed astronomical identity the way that later Western mythographers tended to assume. What is not contested is this. Nearly every surviving account of Coyolxauhqui routes through a single central myth, her defeat at Coatepec, or what's known as Serpent Mountain. Before we can tell that entire story properly, we need to understand the family that she was born into, because in Mexica cosmology, as in so many mythic traditions, lineage is never simply background information. It's the mechanism the entire story runs on. Coyolxauhqui belonged to one of the most consequential divine families in the whole of Mexica cosmology, a family whose internal conflict effectively becomes the myth that explains the sunrise itself. Her mother was Coatlicue, she of the serpent skirt, an earth goddess understood simultaneously as a mother goddess. She was associated with birth, death, fertility, and what scholars often describe as the consuming, devouring power of the earth itself. Coatlicue is frequently depicted in surviving sculpture wearing a skirt that's woven from writhing serpents and a necklace of severed hands and hearts, an image that's meant to convey not villainy in any simple sense, but the totality of the earth's role as both womb and the grave. Her siblings were the Sensenhuitznahua, or the 400 southern stars. In Nahua or Nahuatl, the number 400 rarely functioned as a literal count. It served far more often as an idiom for countless or innumerable, a way of expressing overwhelming multitude rather than a precise census. So when the myth tells us Coyolxauhqui led 400 siblings up the mountain, it's very likely telling us that she led what felt to any observer like the entire visible night sky. And her brother, the figure whose birth reorders everything, was Huitzilopochtli, god of the sun, of war, of fire, and of what the sources consistently describe as sacred destiny. Huitzilopochtli functioned as the patron deity of the Mexica people, specifically the god most directly bound to Tenochtitlan's own sense of purpose and survival, which is part of why the myth of his birth was staged quite literally at the architectural heart of the empire. Sources describing this divine family survive primarily through post-conquest documentation. Above all is Bernardino de Sahagún's monumental Florentine Codex and Diego Duran's History of the Indies of New Spain, both compiled by Spanish friars working directly with the indigenous Nahua informants and the Nahua scribes in the decades following the conquest. The story begins at Coatepec, or Serpent Mountain, a place both mythic and in Mexica cosmology physically real, later reenacted in stone at the very center of Tenochtitlan itself. Coatlicue serves the temple there in quiet sacred devotion, sweeping the summit as part of her daily ritual duty. One day, while sweeping, a ball of feathers descends from the sky and settles near her. Unthinking, or perhaps entirely knowingly, the sources leave this ambiguous. She tucks it into the fold of her clothing, meaning to examine it later. When she reaches for it again, it has vanished. Soon after, she realizes what's happened. She's pregnant. Coyolxauhqui becomes enraged. Her 400 siblings become enraged alongside her. The question that consumed them isn't very abstract. It's deeply, urgently practical, touching directly on questions of honor and legitimacy. Who is the father? How could their mother, who sworn to sacred devotion, have become pregnant with no husband, no explanation, nothing but a vanished ball of feathers to account for it? Coyolxauhqui doesn't simply feel this anger privately. She organizes it. She gathers the 400 siblings, and together, in full war regalia, they begin the climb up Coatepec, intending to kill their mother before the shame of her pregnancy can be allowed to stand. But one sibling breaks from the group and warns the unborn child. Inside the womb, Huitzilopochtli begins to prepare. The attackers reach the summit, and at that precise moment, not before, not after, but exactly as Coyolxauhqui and her siblings arrive at the top of the mountain, Huitzilopochtli is born. Not born as an infant, as a fully formed, fully armed warrior, divine and complete from his very first breath, carrying the Huitzilopochtli, the fire serpent, as his weapon. He attacks immediately, the 400 siblings scatter into the night sky, becoming, in the astronomical reading of this myth, the visible stars themselves, forever fleeing the dawn that is about to arrive. Coyolxauhqui doesn't scatter with them. She is struck directly, decapitated, dismembered. Her body is thrown from the summit, tumbling down the slope of Huatepec in pieces. The Florentine Codex records that moment with a brevity that somehow makes it more chilling. And it reads the following: he pierced Coyolxauhqui, and then quickly her head was cut off. It stopped there at Coatepec. Her limbs separate as she falls. Her body breaks apart on the mountainside. The stars, her siblings, vanish from the sky one by one. Dawn comes. In some later tellings, softened, perhaps by the retelling itself, Huitzilopochtli throws his sister's severed head into the sky after her, so that Coatlicue, in her grief, might still see her daughter each night, and it becomes, in this version, the moon itself, forever chasing the sun that killed her, forever caught, and forever just out of reach. Most people learning of this myth today ask this one question: why so much violence? To understand this, we do have to set aside the assumptions that myth exists primarily to entertain or even to moralize, and instead maybe understand how deeply functional myth was within Mexica cosmology. Central to that cosmology is a concept often rendered in Nahuatl as Teotl, a sacred animating force understood to permeate all of existence. It's not confined to any single god or even a temple, but running through the world the way that blood runs through our bodies. The cosmos in this framework wasn't a static cosmos. It required active nourishment, maintenance, ongoing participation from both the gods and the humans alike. Central to this as well was the Mexica belief that the current world was not the first. Previous cosmic eras, previous suns, had already run their course and ended in catastrophe. Humanity now existed within what was called the fifth sun, understood as a genuinely fragile cosmic era that one could, in theory, end exactly as the four before it had. Within that framework, the moon and stars were never passive decorations hung across a fixed sky. They were living, active participants in an ongoing cosmic struggle that had to be continually renewed or risk collapsing entirely. Many scholars read the Coyolxauhqui myth astronomically, almost as a kind of sacred clock built out of narrative. Huitzilopochtli represents the rising sun. Coyolxauhqui represents moonlight and, by extension, starlight, overcome and driven from the sky by that same dawn. Her 400 siblings represent the visible stars, disappearing one by one as morning approaches, a nightly silent reenactment of the very battle the myth describes. As historian David Carrasco has written of this dynamic, the struggle at Coatepec functioned as something considerably larger than a simple family drama. He says the cosmic struggle represented social order and sacred obligation. For the Mexica, in other words, this myth was never only an origin story. It was an instruction manual. It explained not merely why the sun rises, but what humanity owed the cosmos in exchange for that sunrise continuing to happen at all. A debt understood as active, ongoing, and inescapably communal. The great temple of Tenochtitlan, the Templo Mayor, didn't merely commemorate this cosmology from a distance. It embodied it physically in stone at the literal center of the Mexica capital. Built at the heart of the city, the Templo Mayor was crowned by two shrines that were standing side by side atop a single pyramid. One belonged to Tlaloc, god of rain and agriculture, essential to the harvest that fed the empire. The other belonged to Huitzilopochtli, sun, war, and the sacred destiny that had, according to Mexica belief, guided their ancestors on a long migration to this exact site. The site of the temple dedicated to Huitzilopochtli was understood architecturally and ritually as Coatepec itself, a mountain rebuilt in stone at the center of an entire civilization, so that the myth of Coyolxauhqui's defeat wasn't simply told, but physically walked through generation after generation by anyone who climbed those temple stairs. And at the base of Huitzilopochtli's side of the temple, archaeologists uncovered something extraordinary that confirmed exactly how literally the Mexica intended that architecture to be understood. On February 21, 1978, a crew of Mexico City electrical workers digging a routine excavation trench near the city's central plaza struck something that was neither loose soil nor buried concrete. What they had found, entirely by accident, was a massive carved stone disc, roughly 3.25 to 3.4 meters in diameter, weighing close to 8 tons, dating to approximately the reign of the Mexica ruler Ayaxocatl around 1473 CE. The stone depicted Coyolxauhqui dismembered, decapitated, her limbs arranged around her torso in careful, deliberate, unmistakably intentional symbolic composition. It wasn't this chaotic jumble of body parts, but a formal, almost serene arrangement, as though, even in defeat, she had been rendered with a kind of terrible dignity. Archaeologist Eduardo Montezuma, who would go on to direct the resulting excavation, immediately recognized the significance of both the object and, just as critically, its exact placement. The stone set directly at the base of the staircase leading up Huitzilopochtli's side of the temple, meaning that anyone descending those stairs after a ritual at the summit would quite literally walk down onto the image of Coyolxauhqui's fallen, broken body, reenacting her fall from the mountain with their own feet, a ritual movement made to physically retrace cosmic myth. The 1978 discovery did more than recover this single monument. It reignited serious archaeological interest in excavating the buried remains of Tenochtitlan beneath modern Mexico City, ultimately leading to the launch of the Templo Mayor project, one of the most significant archaeological undertakings in 20th century Mesoamerican studies, and one that continues in various forms to this day. Coyolxauhqui herself doesn't appear to have possessed an independent cult, comparable in scale or even organization to major deities like Tlaloc or Huitzilopochtli. Most surviving evidence places her not at the center of her own dedicated worship, but woven directly into the larger ritual structures built around her brother and her mother. Mexica religious life more broadly involved a dense, layered set of practices, offerings of flowers and incense, music, dance, ceremonial performance, temple devotion, and inseparably in the Mexica worldview from all of the above, blood sacrifice, including human sacrifice. It's worth pausing here deliberately because modern discussions often isolate sacrifice from the larger cosmological framework that gave it meaning, treating it as an act of a gratuitous violence disconnected from any surrounding logic. Mexica understanding differed profoundly from that framing. Sacrifice represented reciprocity, the idea that life sustains life, that the cosmos itself required active nourishment from its human participants in the same way it had, according to the myth, once required nourishment and struggle among the gods themselves. As scholar Alfred Lopez Austin puts it, the gods had sacrificed themselves first, humanity existed within obligation. Within this framework, Hoyoshoki's myth functioned across multiple layers simultaneously, as sacred drama reenacted through temple architecture, as ceremony performed at specific calendrical moments, as a source of political legitimacy for a ruling elite who traced their authority directly back to Huitzilopochtli's own mythic triumph, and as cosmic explanation for why the sun rises and the stars retreat every single day without exception. Much of what survives about Hoyoshoki today comes to us through colonial documentation, and this presents real, unavoidable challenges for anyone trying to understand her on her own cultural terms. The Spanish conquest devastated Mexica cultural and even the religious systems with startling speed. Temples were dismantled, manuscripts were burned, entire lines of specialized ritual and astronomical knowledge held by these trained priestly specialists, they were disrupted within a single generation. And yet paradoxically, colonial era texts preserve much of the vital information that we now rely on to reconstruct Hoyoshoki's story at all. Bernardino de Sahagún, a Francisco friar, created the Florentine Codex in close, sustained collaboration with indigenous Nahua scholars and scribes, producing one of the most single important surviving records of Mexica religious life, though shaped throughout this text or this codex inevitably by the colonial and Christian context in which it was compiled. Diego Duran, a Dominican friar, recorded Mexica religion in extensive detail, attempting in his own writing to preserve traditions even as he simultaneously condemned them on theological grounds, a contradiction that runs through much of his surviving work. Fernando Alvarado de Zozomoc, an indigenous noble historian and descendant of Mexica elite lineage, offers a perspective considerably closer to the culture itself, providing us invaluable material that colonial friars, however sympathetic they may have been, simply could not have produced on their own. Modern scholars urge real caution when working with all of these sources. Colonial writers frequently interpreted indigenous religion through their pre-existing Christian assumptions, at times genuinely misunderstanding the core symbolism, at other times deliberately framing Mexica practices in the most negative possible light to justify the broader project of conquest and conversion. Historian Camilla Townsend has urged that indigenous collaborators, the Nahua scribes, the translators, and the informants that were working alongside the friars, like Sahagún, profoundly shaped the surviving accounts in ways that are only now being more fully recognized and even credited. The voices that we inherit, in other words, they're layered. Indigenous memory, colonial interpretation, centuries of archaeological evidence, and modern scholarship all pressed together into a single, incomplete, but genuinely powerful record. So why does any of this matter to us today? Why are modern artists, writers, and healers still obsessing over an Aztec moon goddess who lost a fight thousands of years ago? Because most stories teach us that breaking apart is the worst thing that can ever happen to us. We're taught to hide our scars, glue our lives back together as fast as possible, and pretend that we were never broken in the first place. Hoyoshoki turns that idea entirely on its head. The legendary writer Gloria Anzaldúa looked at this shattered goddess and realized something revolutionary. What if falling apart isn't a failure at all? What if shattering is actually just step one of being a completely new, stronger version of yourself? Think of it like kintsugi, the Japanese art where broken pottery is repaired with gold. Hoyoshoki doesn't ask us to pretend we're pristine porcelain. She shows us that you can be completely undone, scattered in pieces, and still be divine. The wound and the healing aren't total opposites. They're just two parts of the exact same journey. So here's the cosmic plot twist. Myths aren't frozen in dust or even locked away in museum cases. They change, they grow, they keep talking to us, if we're willing to listen. Hoyolshoki was meant to be buried at the bottom of a staircase forever, a warning about what happens when you lose a battle, but instead, she became a symbol for anyone who's ever had to pick up their own scattered pieces off the floor and rebuild. So I'll leave you with this today. The next time life knocks you down so hard that you feel completely unraveled, remember the moon goddess at the base of the mountain. You aren't ruined, you're just in the middle of your redesign.